Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
So let's just kind of hop into it. Again, Kate did a great job of explaining that things are getting hot in here. By any measure, heat waves are becoming more frequent. They're becoming longer in duration by, the actual length of time that certain temperatures go above a particular threshold. They're more intense. The heat waves are becoming, they get hotter than a certain threshold that we might assign to them. And they're happening at weirder times of the year. The actual, you can think of it as like the heat wave season is kind of like fattening out over the edges of its belt, and where it used to occur at a very predictable time of year, we might have them occur earlier in the spring or last longer into the fall. And so this paper from 2015 did a great job of contextualizing this kind of lengthening, strengthening, intensifying, and more frequent kind of heat wave situation across 50 of the largest cities in the United States. This is important to us because this relates directly back to human health. It might come as a surprise that heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard in the United States, even more so than things like flooding, tornadoes, and hurricanes, which tend to be the more, headline-grabbing, breaking news stories. Extreme heat is truly the kind of silent killer. And we didn't learn that somewhere better, I think, in this country than 25 years ago in the city of Chicago. At this time, temperatures went well over 100 degrees for several days. It didn't cool down overnight, and over 700 people died in this extreme heat wave. Most of those deaths occurred in elderly communities of color. And interestingly, I have a direct connection to this event because at this time I was growing up in the northwestern suburbs, which, if you know anything about Chicagoland, that's very, white middle class kind of upbringing. And I actually remember this weekend in 1995, my family had a backyard party. We had baby pools and air conditioning, and we ate, frozen ice cream pops and things like that. Meanwhile, just a few miles away on the other side of town, people were going through something that looked like this. And so that kind of imprint, as I became an adult and learned about climate change and then learned about how health disparity is linked to these climate stressors, I had to reflect on my upbringing and really and start to interact with this information in a real meaningful way. And one of the ways that you can do that if you're interested in learning more about this particular event is to read the book Heatwave by Eric Kleinenberg, who's a sociologist who spent a lot of time kind of dissecting why certain areas had higher death rates across the city of Chicago. One of the most captivating results of his work was to align areas that had the highest heat-related death rates, which are these areas of the city that are shaded in gray, and then cross-referencing that with the same areas that have the highest percentage of persons below poverty. What he was able to uncover is that this idea of disinvestment in these communities created fractured and non-connected, very limited social infrastructure that kept these individuals, these elderly people of color, safe during this heat wave.
Context of white supremacy. Contextualizing. Heard that? Contextualizing. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, September 28, 2020. So I have been told we should be here on Wednesday. Totally different subject matter, talking about language. So important, something we've emphasized for years here on the broadcast, but that'll be Wednesday, and continuing with the book club. Thursday, Cased Isabel Wilkerson, Session 4. Man, oh man, for years at the Cows, I acknowledged, I try to be truthful. We all have deficiencies, right? Still learning. I say that, I think many folks say that for a reason, just being truthful. One of the areas, nearly a dozen years since we've been back on the air, one of the areas that I acknowledged for a long time, we have a massive deficit. We have not done nearly enough to talk about environmental racism. Like, that is huge. It has such an immense impact on the health of black people, non-white people all over the world. Has come up, you know, explicitly in COVID-19. For years I said, wow, we get an F in this subject matter. We've not, you know, covered it at all. 2020, the year of the Rona, we do not have an F in that subject matter anymore. Just with the work we've done this year and a few other tidbits, not an A+, but we definitely have covered some of those deficiencies a bit. For this program, I would encourage folks, check the archives, since we're going to be talking about Chicago a little bit. You already heard some. Wowee. I get proud when I check the reference sources for some of our guests or hear who they reference when they talk about that sort of thing. What have we been doing for 12 years? So Dr. Nancy Krieger, guest on The Cows, 2009, talked about her work with health and racism. N.D.B. Connolly, guest on The Cows, 2015. We talked about his book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow in South Florida. One of the best books I've read on racism, white supremacy. Outstanding effort. This year from the book club, Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. In my top 10, she has two books in the top 10. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, you get a twofer here because we read her book, Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954. We read the book in the book club, and then she was a guest on the program for Earth Day this year, and it was stunning because that was right at the time in April when they were reporting about the impact of COVID-19 on black people, and it lined in a really tragic, perfect way with her work, where she talked about some of the exact things that we're talking about today. But that is a twofer, so you get the book club, and she was actually here in person for Earth Day this year. And Beryl Satter, Family Properties, her book Family Properties, How the Struggle Over Race and Real Estate Transformed Chicago and Urban America. She was here days after N.D.B. Connolly. We did all of our real estate racism right at the same time, April 2015. Excellent book, particularly for our context today, but contextualizing our discussion for today and some of our work here at The Cows for a number of years, hopefully constructive. Our guest for today, they've been having a lot of conversations about extreme heat that has been near and dear to Gus T. Renegade here in Seattle, where, as I've said for weeks, I couldn't even open my blinds. All of the smoke and what have you that was in the air drifting through, that was the whole West Coast, and the air quality was, let me use the terms that they gave from the report. So for about 2 weeks, we had very unhealthy and or harmful air quality because of the fires that were happening in the area. Thankfully, a lot of that has cleared, so we have much better air. But with all of that conversation this year, a number of fascinating reports came out. Our guest authored some, produced some of the great research that we're going to talk about. He is a professor at the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs at Virginia Commonwealth University. He is the chief scientist at the Science Museum of Virginia, holds a PhD in geology from Oregon State University, and conducts a lot of great research that we will talk about in terms of the correlation between redlining, extreme heat in urban areas, particularly where black people, non-white people reside. Real pleasure to have him on the program. Joining us live, Dr. Jeremy S. Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman, are you with us?
Yeah, Gus, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Thus far, you're coming through clear. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm really thrilled to hear this group of folks that have been on your show before. You know, I was actually going to mention some of Nancy Krieger's recent work, as an extension of the work that we did on extreme heat. So it's a pleasure to get to connect with you. Thank you so much.
We will enjoy hearing. Yeah, that'd be great to hear updates on her. Where I thought she, in fact, for listeners, I don't know if you've been listening that long, she was the first person to introduce the concept of John Henryism. I had not heard it until she came on the broadcast, and she actually, I did what I said, still learning. I said, what does that mean? She just used it, and she took her time and explained the concept. We have used it frequently. John Henryism. You can go back in the archives. For folks, this might be their first time hearing about who you are, the work you do. Anything that you'd like to share briefly about your work, Dr. Hoffman?
Sure, yeah. So I'm the chief scientist at the Science Museum of Virginia, where we try to enrich or get Virginians to enrich their lives through science. And over the last several years, I've started there in 2016. We've had a focus on communicating the impacts of climate change on communities. You know, I think a lot of the times we think of climate change as this very far away thing, both in time, like it's not happening right now, and in relation to ourselves, like it's not happening here. So those two things help us kind of psychologically distance ourselves from the impacts of climate change, which are very real, happening now and happening in our backyards. So what's been really fun about the work at the Science Museum is trying to not only engage people where they're at, you know, in their backyards about climate change, but to actually include them and include communities in understanding their climate-related stressors. So it's a joy to get to be able to share that with your listeners, Gus.
We appreciate the chance to learn. For folks who haven't seen, you have videos on this topic where you seem very passionate about sharing what you've learned. You are a white man, is that correct? Oh, are you with us, Dr. Hoffman? Oh, it looks like I lost my signal for a second. Okay. Are you hearing me, Dr. Hoffman?
Oh, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I can hear you. It's like, what happened? Lost out for a second. I guess the signal dropped for a moment. I was saying, you, for folks who have not seen some of your videos where you talk very passionately about this subject matter, trying to educate folks, you are a white man. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, yes.
Right on. This program, I use the terms racism and white supremacy as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, you know, I've had to really explore this concept of white supremacy. And the more and more I learn about it, and the more and more I try and look at, you know, what information we have and explaining these disparities in our communities, the more and more it's clear that, you know, the everything that's happened before I arrived on this planet has sought to, you know, to separate people in not only categories, but, you know, these long-term impacts related to health and security and income. So I do agree with your definition, and certainly I'm learning as much as I can. Just like you said, you like to learn. I'm here to learn from you, Gus. And so yeah, you know, it's something I have to keep trying to learn about and make myself uncomfortable with to grow and to change.
Can you unpack one thing that you said right there? You said something that you're still learning yourself. You came here to learn, but you said something that you have to make yourself uncomfortable with. What is uncomfortable about learning about racism, white supremacy for you as a white man?
Well, so yeah, that's I appreciate that level of detail. So, you know, every single room that I've ever walked into for, you know, most of my life has been, you know, a room where white male, you know, privilege and power, you know, is inherent to it. And so learning about that level of privilege, like as you played with my, you know, the clip from my talk, you know, where I learned about how just a few miles away from my family's yard party, you know, there were people, black people, dying from heat. And the kind of system that's behind that disparity, you know, when you're not brought up, you know, in a educational system that, you know, that works to address and understand and learn about that system of power that's inherent to every space that I have ever inhabited, you know, so that, you know, it's like anytime you get your worldview shaken, I think it's important to feel uncomfortable. That's the only way to really have to defend or to change that worldview, is through being made uncomfortable by topics that you might be unfamiliar with. I mean, the same goes with like learning about geological time for the first time. You know, I was raised somewhat religiously, and to hear that the Earth is, you know, 14 or 4.6 billion years old and humans have been around for 300,000 years of that, you know, that kind of worldview shaking information is something that I think everybody should be reckoning with. And so I mean uncomfortable in that, you know, addressing and understanding and just identifying where the like white male privilege and power system lies in my life is something that is, yeah, it is uncomfortable, but it's something that, again, in order to change and make positive change in the world, I think we all need to be exploring that and learning about it.
Much obliged. Thank you for your answer, Dr. Hoffman. I have, over the years, we've asked many of our white guests. This is a sentence. This is a report that a non-white author, where he was explicitly addressing racism in the publishing industry, and he wrote, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough." As a white man, your time around white people, and certainly now with more of your studies dealing with racism, redlining, and such, just based on the white people that you've been around talking about this subject matter, do you think, based on evidence, that a substantial number of white people are sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
That's a really, really good question. I think the level, you know, I think for many people, you know, this time in the last 6 months has been, for many people, you know, a time of at least being shown just how inequitable, you know, the systems that have been set up in our country and in large part the world operate. Would I say that like most white people are made to the same extent that I know that my black and brown friends are made uncomfortable and pained by racism? Like there's no, I don't think there's any comparison. And certainly, like, you know, like I said, like every single room that I've ever walked into privileges my voice over others. So there's no way, until that kind of systematic you know, power dynamic is addressed and, you know, dismantled, that it, there's no way I could even suppose to know what that kind of pain is, Gus. And so to make a kind of sweeping generalization about white people, but I think I can, in the fact that there's no way that we can even begin to understand the kind of generational trauma. And yeah, I think the more I learn about it, absolutely, the less I think that we can even truly begin to grasp some of the pain and or all of the pain that is experienced through racism. So, I mean, you brought up John Henryism, you know, and I mean, there's this idea of like generational trauma that white communities just simply don't have the same connection to. And, you know, that bears out today, you know, in mental health and physical health and life expectancy, which is kind of what is tied back to the research that we've been doing. And people like Nancy and other folks around the country really showing just like how different 2 days in the same city or same neighborhood can be based on your zip code.
Not by accident. Context of white supremacy. One quick thing I did want to share, just because I felt I just said this. This happens frequently with the cows. The word separate was used. You talked about keeping white people in black people separate, and for this study, I mean, certainly what you just said, depending on which zip code you had, totally different life expectancy. Absolutely. Even in some of the research that I was looking at with the redlining, sometimes that might be enough, not just having a black person live in your area, having a black person walk through the area might be enough to get you downgraded if that type of thing happens too much. So that is true. But really what we're talking about in the system of white supremacy is power, not necessarily separation. I mean, a plantation, the slave master and the slaves are not separate. Even under so-called Jim Crow, Strom Thurmond is not separate from black people totally. I mean, he's raping his house servant, producing a child with her. So the system of white supremacy is not essentially about separation as much it is about power and domination. That's one thing that I think is super important. Am I being logical, Dr. Hoffman?
Sure, yeah. And I you know, that idea of concentrating power in particular areas, you know, versus, you know, reducing access or fully restricting access to power through, you know, wealth is what is pretty much kind of at the center of what we've seen redlining do over generations. So, yeah, I think you're being logical, Gus.
Right on. Chicago, what a city. I told Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's book, Environmental Racism, exclusively focused on Chicago for about a 100-year period. We've done a lot of study of Beryl Satter's work, family property, redlining, specifically in Chicago. Her white father owned and rented property to black people, so he witnessed this firsthand. In fact, Beryl Satter, we asked her in 2015, and her book goes into a lot of detail about what they were doing to black people in Chicago, specifically piling them into these fire traps and putting them into houses where they would charge them 3-4 times what the property is worth. And then if they mess up and miss a payment, even if they are like 90% close to paying off the property, too bad, you missed a payment, kick them out. Keep all of that money, get a new black family, put them in, and do the same thing. She talked about how this went on for years, talking about wealth disparity or what have you. But I asked her, because she has, I think it's the second chapter in her book, is a noose around the neck of Chicago, talking about this renting, because they restricted where black people could live. It was like a noose. And I said, lynching, that's an act of terrorism. Is it accurate to call this economic terrorism, redlining, and what, you know, restricting black people where they can live and the crushing impact that this has on black people for generations? And she said, absolutely. And she went into detail with her work. You've looked at a lot of the same research, NDB Connolly. Do you think that's accurate, that this is economic terrorism, redlining, that that's what we're talking about?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, I'm much more of a, you know, again, like climate scientist by training. So I'll take, you know, economic expertise any day over my own, Gus. But certainly the idea that if, you know, and I'm going to try and be logical here myself, is like, you know, redlining was done without the inclusion of these communities in the decision to do this thing. So, you know, and it has long lasting nefarious outcomes for entire communities. So, you know, if that in the eyes of a well-respected economist is as you describe it, like, I think I don't have a good word for it. So if it's, if that's what a, you know, if that's what we want to call it, absolutely. I mean, I don't have a good working understanding of, you know, the kind of level of expertise as these other folks. So I'll support their interpretation.
Encourage folks, check out that broadcast with Beryl Satter, where she, and her book. It's, I believe, like I said, it's the second chapter, A Noose Around the Neck of Chicago, in terms of restricting black people and the fear component, because that's in most definitions of terrorism, to have people fearful of responding or to do things to them so that they will be fearful. Absolutely. If you move outside of this area, I think Chicago, for generations, lots of fear tactics to make sure that black people didn't venture out into white areas. Just when you shared, we opened with a clip that was you kind of talking about growing up in Chicago and not really being aware of some of these differences. When they had this massive heat wave about a quarter century ago, you said you're enjoying, you know, frozen popsicles and having a pool party in this predominantly white enclave. And then in the poor section of town, mostly non-white people, they are struggling, lots of deaths, no pools, long legacy of black people being denied access to pools under the system of racism. But just, can you talk more about your experience growing up as a white child in Chicago and not being aware?
Yeah. So certainly I think I was really fortunate to go to a school that was diverse in that I had, you know, it wasn't predominantly white, like where I ended up moving to in later in life and everything. But the, you know, the fact of the matter being that, you know, when we were, and again, this is like the total, you know, naiveness of folks that grow up, and it's not something that is talked about very often. You know, my family was Polish, Irish, and from the south side of Chicago, not far from the White Sox, the Comiskey Park. And you know, what's interesting in some ways about you know, the family background, you know, it's like that was at the height, you know, in the early years after redlining occurred and like urban renewal and all that kind of thing. And so anyway, you know, this experience in the summertime, you know, I was always like a sweaty kid. I never really liked being outside in the heat, Gus, and I still don't. but the fact that, like, you know, I didn't know, and I was too young, maybe, I, you know, I don't know for sure whether I'm, you know, just was naive to what was going on in the newspapers, but the fact that across, you know, the city, just a few miles away from me, you know, they were parking, you know, frozen, like morgue trucks, basically. They pulled in a number of, like, you know, truck company freezing, you know, truck containers because there were so many excess deaths occurring because of this heat in particular areas. So, yeah, so, I mean, my experience was so much different than that. So now I spend a lot of my scientific energy seeking to understand more about those disparities and communicate it to the public.
But to pivot to talk about some of your research specifically on redlining and the correlation with these high temperature areas, high temperature urban areas, you have a PhD in geology, paleoclimatology. Did you have black classmates, black instructors throughout your undergraduate, graduate career?
No, you know, not as many. I was thinking about, you know, I went to a Lutheran undergraduate college, and you know, I had actually the really fortunate experience of being in a play that we all wrote together with a small group of students, black and brown students, and you know, that I remember hearing, you know, from them very loud and clearly that, you know, they wanted more representation in the faculty. And I know that since then that's been worked on to the extent that it's, you know, representative. I don't imagine so, but graduate school, I went to graduate school at Oregon State. The history of the state of Oregon even is you know, troublesome with it being kind of touted as a white utopia. So the long lasting impacts of that, on top of, you know, the redlining in Portland occurred as well. But anyway, as far as, teachers know, you know, the college I went to, earth sciences are traditionally been, you know, a white male dominated, school of research. And, you know, my institution was no different.
What about your current institution in Virginia? Do you have any black faculty members in the department?
Yeah, the Virginia Commonwealth University, you know, L. Douglas Wilder, the school that's named after, was the first black governor of Virginia, has a long history of political roles in the state of Virginia, we're really fortunate in that both our campus and our faculty are in the Wilder School is diverse, I don't know the numbers off the back of my hand, but it, you know, far more so than the other institutions that I've been affiliated with, that is the case.
Okay, right on. Born in Virginia, I am very familiar with Mr. former Governor Douglas Wilder. In fact, we were just talking about former Governor Wilder saved Allen Iverson's life. John Thompson just died, former coach at Georgetown, and Allen Iverson is an alumnus there, and former resident of Virginia who was in greater confinement. Were it not for Doug Wilder, who was governor at the time, we might not know his name, but yeah, we mentioned Mr. Wilder often for many reasons. We mentioned him frequently. One thing that I wanted to get you to share about, I think is so important about your work in terms of this intense heat. I live in Seattle, so during this summer, where they were having all of the intense heat, Seattle generally doesn't have very hot summers anyway. Like, I think our average summertime high is a little below 80 degrees. I think it's over 60% of the houses here do not have air conditioning because it just doesn't get very hot here frequently. So I think in August, when they were having the heat waves and it was really bad in many places, here that meant it was like 83 degrees, which is not exactly a heat wave, but warmer than what, you know, it normally is. So I'm sitting outside, I'm talking to a non-white person, victim of racism, and she says, oh man, they're having the heat wave right now, I love it, I'd love to be in some of those areas where it's 100 degrees and that type of thing. And I said, wow, that intense heat is really dangerous, like a lot of people die, like that's not just something to go out and enjoy. And she said, really? I said, yeah, I think that's like way worse than like extreme cold or a lot of other problems. Just can you talk about the health effects of intense heat?
Yeah, so the you know, now we're getting better and better at understanding how extreme heat affects us as we explore more and more about these things. And so first and foremost, basically, if you have any sort of chronic condition, you know, a COPD or asthma, especially respiratory things, that extreme heat constricts your airways beyond what it is anyways, because of your condition. So breathing related, like obstruction is worse. during extreme heat. So some people succumb to, you know, those sorts of issues. But then you have people that work outside, maybe suffer heat stress and heat stroke. We know a large part of our heat-related illness responses in the city of Richmond are related to that kind of heat stress and heat stroke. People out and about. So overexertion, you know, is a real serious thing. Basically, if you have any underlying condition, extreme heat can either worsen or, you know, exacerbate that condition. So, when we talk about the number of deaths, you know, in Chicago, you know, the number of illnesses or morbidity, you know, across a lot of different related health issues get worse when it comes to heat. So it's really, you know, not only a silent killer, but it's also this kind of silent worse amplifier of everybody's underlying condition.
In your report that was published this year, which you co-authored, The Effects of Historical Housing Policies on Resident Exposure to Intra-Urban Heat, a study of 108 U.S. urban areas, you all write, no other category of hazardous weather event in the United States has caused more fatalities over the last few decades than extreme heat. In fact, extreme heat is the leading cause of summertime morbidity and has specific impacts on those communities with pre-existing health conditions, for example, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, cardiovascular disease, etc., limited access to resources, and the elderly. Excess heat limits the human body's ability to regulate its internal temperature, which can result in increased cases of heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke, and may exacerbate other nervous system, respiratory, cardiovascular, genitourinary, and diabetes-related conditions. When I read this, I thought, wow, this sounds a lot like Harriet A. Washington's A Terrible Thing to Waste, where she cites a lot of the same conditions being exacerbated by being in these areas where they have deliberately allowed a lot of toxic substances and things, asphalt, bus terminals, so that people will be more likely to be sick and have problems with their brain. That's what her whole book is about. But this also reminded me exactly of the COVID-19 comorbidities and people who are more likely to be impacted. Just can you speak a little bit about the correlation between what you talk about with the intense heat and what they've talked about all year with COVID-19?
Yep. Absolutely, Gus. So this is where things, you know, I think have really started to bring some of these issues to the forefront and really underscore the kind of public health implications of living in particular neighborhoods versus others. And so when we look at the things that make people vulnerable to extreme heat, those respiratory issues, those underlying conditions, those same conditions are worsened or predispose people to have a very, very serious case of COVID. So when you just look at kind of the risk, health-related risks of being exposed to heat or being or contracting COVID-19, those areas look very much the same. But also, when you dig into these kinds of the neighborhood characteristics, like the type of job that these individuals might have, the types of housing that they have, like multi-generational housing tend to be those that have spread within the family units more so than if someone lives alone. So when smoking is certainly another thing that can predispose problems with both. And so when you look at the maps of heat vulnerability or inequitable exposure to heat, and then vulnerability or risks associated with COVID, here in Richmond, they look like the same map. And our mayor, LeVar Stoney, actually gave a presentation on Facebook Live after the sustainability office here in Richmond, which is doing a climate action plan called RVA Green 2050, basically showed him these maps, and he really did a good job explaining how these things are inequitably related to the living conditions and the kind of built environment in these different neighborhoods. And now we've seen this play out in many different cities, where in Chicago, the map of COVID cases overlaps very closely with the same map of heat deaths from 1995, the map that I described earlier in the opening audio. So really, these kinds of, these related, so when you see something like that, Gus, a novel coronavirus and extreme heat waves affecting the exact same people, you have to ask yourself, why, how did this come to be this way? And I think that that's what's really fascinating about then entering in the redlining maps from the 1930s and 1940s.
Context of white supremacy. Just one more component to the health aspect, because I think all of this is, super vital. I think lots of people probably, as a silent killer, would not think about heat as being, oh, wow, that's, a real health hazard, intense heat, but also a mental health problem. I certainly had not thought about that. The New York Times had a report that came out just a few months ago, last August, it's almost October basically, how decades of racist housing policy left neighborhoods sweltering, where they're talking about your work and looking at this subject matter. And they included the mental health component, and they cited a study, possible biological mechanisms linking mental health and heat, a contemplative review. And just giving folks a tad, it says, this review provides examples of possible biological mechanisms that could at least partly explain the existing epidemiological evidence of heat wave related exacerbation of mental disease morbidity. The author reviews the complicated central processes involved in the challenge of maintaining a stable body temperature in hot environments and the maladaptive effects of certain psychiatric medicines on thermoregulation. In addition, the author discusses some alternative mechanisms, such as interrupted functional brain connectivity and the effect of disrupted sleep. Oh, that's right. I hadn't even thought about that. When it's all, it is a little bit more difficult to sleep when it's, wow. Can you just, because I had never considered all that. Can you touch on this a bit, Dr. Hoffman?
Yeah, of course. And so, all right, so I'm going to start. One of the central findings of our paper was not so, well, beyond just the temperature differences between these neighborhoods, but also the disparity in the amount of green spaces that exists within these cities. So you think there's a growing body of evidence to show that when people interact in green spaces, natural spaces, their sympathetic nervous system responds. So they actually have heightened arousal. They are their heart rate variation is researched with Jenny Rowe's office at University of Virginia, looking at this here in Richmond, where we sent people out into to take two walks. And one walk took you down a very busy urban street, Broad Street here in Richmond, right in front of the Science Museum of Virginia. And then another one that took you down into the Fan, which is one of the more kind of canopied, taller buildings, a little bit more controlled, not as much traffic. And the evidence clearly suggests that even just being among these greener environments, our stress levels are reduced. So there's like kind of just that, if you imagine waking up, in a concrete jungle and you have to walk to work or walk to the bus and there's no shade for you to take, take a little bit of time off under, or a shade structure at your bus stop, and then you get on that bus and go work in a, maybe an outdoor environment or some, restaurant setting or, some sort of busy kind of job like that, you can kind of think of it as like a bank account of exposure to extreme heat. Just throughout your entire day, Then you come home and you can't cool down in your house that doesn't have air conditioning or doesn't have very good ventilation. So it's really just this entire day of no tree canopy, no respite from the heat. And then you come home and try and sleep after being exposed to this hot environment the whole day. And then kind of contrast that experience with someone that has, 85% tree canopy in their neighborhood, and it's very calm, and they can walk around their neighborhood, and it's like natural air conditioning. You know, it just becomes like which environment would you rather go to, Gus? it's really the mental health related issues of this extreme heat, not only affecting us during the heat wave, but just overall the kind of built environment around us has such a huge impact on that kind of mental state that you can experience throughout your day.
Context of white supremacy. I will answer your question, Dr. Hoffman, as someone who has lived in Virginia, lived in Atlanta, and has now lived. I have not just lived in Seattle for over a decade. I have referenced Seattle for years as the best plantation easily in the U.S. Easily. Green everything. I have not one. I have two Asian pear trees in the backyard. I remember what it's like, though, to be in Atlanta and Virginia, particularly where the black people live. I don't remember a single Asian pear tree, not one. It's asphalt, concrete, exactly what you and it's not just the health cost, mental health cost, physical cost we talked about. So, okay, if you have enough nickels, you can run your air conditioner, but now, oh, man, what is your energy bill going to be if you have to offset to that to have the air conditioner on all the time, and you might not have central air, because you talk about that as well.
Yeah, so there's this idea of energy burden, Gus, and basically it's where, people, and when your energy costs are more than a certain threshold of your income, that becomes a serious issue. So in the summertime, if you have to decide between, paying your air conditioning or your energy bill or buying the groceries, or paying rent, here in Virginia, we're facing this very severe eviction crisis. All of these things interact to basically, like, if it's hotter in your neighborhood and you have to use more AC because your housing stock or the house that you live in doesn't have the same weather efficiency as some other newer homes or what have you, you end up using more energy per particular heat wave than someone else across the city that has natural air conditioning from the trees that are around their neighborhood. So, literally any aspect of a person's day living in some of these, treeless heat islands is just so fundamentally different and basically stacked to have higher costs related to health, and house and food. Cause then you also, these redlined areas, tend to be food deserts in a lot of cities. So not only that, but you it's the lack of access to kind of like fresh food. And, my colleague Duran Chavis talks about this all the time. He's an urban farmer here in Richmond, and he's been working on something called resiliency gardens in the city of Richmond. You might look him up because he's just doing this fascinating work trying to get people to grow their own food at this really trying time that we're living through. And it's all focused on building resilience to redlining and environmental injustice. And so anyway, just to say that, the impact of this on your cost of living is real.
Context of white supremacy. What's the person's name again with the resiliency gardens?
Yeah, Duran Chavis, Chavis. His Twitter handle is Brother Manifest, and he's a really good colleague of mine, and I really value. He and I work on a lot of projects together in the city of Richmond. He was actually one of the first people to get me going on this redlining thing and really start to investigate what the impacts of that are on people's lives in the city of Richmond.
Awesome. Daron Chavis. Okay. I will check him out after the broadcast. One other thing when I was, or there were many things, but when I was reading your work, you also talked about, because I would have thought, okay, grass would be better. Like, if we have grass outside, then that should cool the area down. And when you all did some of the more detailed exploration, you found that grass might not be that much better. It would be better to have more native plants, like in Virginia, to have native plants that would do a better job to cool some of the area. Just can you talk about some of the detail in terms of what types of, whether you're having grass, native plants, asphalt, in terms of the difference that makes on the temperature?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite things to talk about related to this, to like our long-term, like how do we include the community's vision for, you know, a healthy community as we kind of try and set these things right in as many ways as we can. And one of the key things is that grass, just green, it's non-native, it's European, a lot of the grasses that we use, you know, and they were popularized in like the 16 and 1700s, you know, these big French lawns that are obsessively manicured. Well, it turns out that those grasses have very shallow roots. These grasses don't reach down very far into the underlying soil. So they don't tap rich wealth of groundwater that's underneath them. There's more and more moisture as you go further down into the, in many places. The general idea is that as you go down, there's more moisture. So, when it gets really dry out, and usually these heat waves correspond to, you know, kind of rainless time periods, unless you're in Miami, and then it's just like heat and humidity the whole day, and it could rain or could not, but it'll still be 100 degrees. Anyway, where these places where we have kind of like heat and dryness corresponding, so when it's really hot, it's really dry, if that grass isn't very well manicured or watered, then it can actually have the same surface temperatures as a cement. Basically, huge areas of grass that's dry during a heat wave virtually acts, at least from the sense of like a heat sensor, like a big paved area of cement. So what do we do instead? Well, at the Science Museum of Virginia, actually, we have a native plant garden. It's all Virginia natives, things like creeping phlox, which is really beautiful, purple flowers, black-eyed Susans, some other really beautiful things. And anyway, those have very deep roots. And so they create their root systems down far enough so that they can be using the groundwater resources much more efficiently. That allows them, during these heat waves, to remain relatively cooler than the non-native grasses that might be growing right nearby. And so all we have to do is take a thermal photo of a parking lot that has both native and non-native plants in it, and you'll see the difference right away. It's really amazing. So when we think about how to, like, you know, improve the heat island in some places, you know, where do you think of when you hear, you know, big plots of grass? A lot of the times our schools are surrounded by these big plots of grass that take a lot of work to manicure and mow and water. Well, if we instead allowed them to be, you know, something like a learning laboratory for students to learn about native plants and biodiversity, they take less work and they keep us cooler, at least for surface temperature. So it's kind of a really interesting and not largely known thing, I think, Gus.
Fascinating. When I was reading your research, as I said, still learning. But I totally agree in terms of just looking, the areas that I've been where it's predominantly black people, generally they don't even have grass. A lot of time it's just concrete, asphalt, like that's it. I mean, they might have dirt. That's what I'm trying to think back in different locations. Yeah, it's not trees, it's not grass, it'll be dirt, concrete, asphalt. It's just nothing to offer any cooling or any of the mental relaxation. And I contrast that with Seattle, and in particular, Seattle, where they do not have very many black people, they have more parks within Seattle proper, within the city, more parks within the city limits than almost any, compared to Atlanta, where they have a huge population of black people. I don't remember a whole lot of parks in Atlanta. There are tons of parks in Seattle, trees, flowers. I'm not informed enough about plant life to know, wow, to see if they have native, you know, plants and such, but lots of trees, really that calming effect there. And it's not even that hot, just heat.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that there was a recent study by the Trust for Public Land or the Urban Land Institute, one of those two, that showed that, you know, communities, black communities and communities of color traditionally have not only fewer parks, but the parks that they do have are much smaller than the communities, than parks that are serving more white communities. So not only are there fewer of them, Gus, but they tend to be much smaller in space, which is actually one of the interesting projects that we have going on here in the city of Richmond, where we've just, the mayor's office announced a new initiative to transfer 5 parcels of city-owned land in the south side of Richmond, which is predominantly a black community and Latinx community, where they'll be putting five new parks that are very large in space. So we're hopefully, the idea is now that the parcels are kind of part of the plan. Now it's what do these communities want to see in these spaces? What would help? What would make them use them? What would be accommodating? What would be culturally appropriate? What would reflect their voice and vision? And so that's part of what I loved about the work with Duran and several other people in the environmental community here in Richmond, is that we really want to include the community kind of from the ground up, literally, when it comes to these parks. And so it's really, really one small way of addressing this, you know, large disparity that we uncovered in our paper.
Dr. Jeremy Hoffman with us live on the Cows. If you have a question, listeners, you'd like to ask, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61. If you would like to participate, let's see, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. Messed up the audio. We'll get that corrected. All righty. Are you familiar with the Kerner Report, which was published in the 1960s? It was after they had a lot of the so-called riots and what have you. And so I think this was Johnson. They got some of the white Congress members to sit down and kind of figure out what was causing all of these disturbances. Have you heard of that report, the Kerner Report?
No, but I'd love to learn about it.
Okay. I'm sure you can get a copy. They probably got it at the library at your institution, or you can buy a copy, whatever it is. But it gets referenced frequently, particularly any time that they have riots. Like, I think 2015 with Mr. Gray in Baltimore, Michael Brown Jr. 2014 in Ferguson, when they have these uprisings, these incidents, they will reference it often. And I mention it because it's one of the more popular one of these reports, but they kind of go into detail and talking about racism and black people having poor housing and poor jobs and some of the same problems that we've been talking about today, and they still don't do anything to address. I reference that report because, at least it seems to me, white people will produce a number of different documents that outline what the problem is in terms of how racism, white supremacy is impacting black people, non-white people, but they still don't get around to stopping the racism, white supremacy and solving these problems. So I want to know, with your work, like, particularly, that's why I asked that question at the beginning about white people being sincerely pained. Like, are they, white people, a substantial number of them, are they serious? Like, you know what, this is true. this is what we have done with redlining and all of this to black people. Let's go about the business of solving this problem on a wide-scale basis. Like, have you seen that sort of response to your work?
Well, I've certainly seen, at least in the, and I can't speak to, you know, outside of Richmond, because I think that the, in Richmond, at least two things come to mind, or several things come to mind, and I'll try my best to characterize the work. There's a research group in the L. Douglas Weiler School, the RVA Eviction Lab, which has identified, you know, Richmond consistently, you know, near the top of kind of eviction rates disproportionately befalling black individuals and black families. And so, you know, there's discussion, and I mean, certainly probably in my opinion, not happening fast enough to accommodate, you know, affordable housing in our city, among others, you know, the ability to have, you know, multi-income types of developments, and that sort of thing. We have a city plan called Richmond 300 that is trying to be, adopted at the time and right now. And so that seeks to ameliorate large differences in access to green spaces, access to transportation, you know, because I think really what you're getting at is like how much, where are the kinds of knobs that we can turn as white people? And so things that come to mind are things like green spaces, you know, like where are we prioritizing access to green spaces? If those green spaces can be located nearby regional transit hubs, or neighborhood transit and transportation hubs like bus stops, you know, there's this really amazing project that I just saw come out of Groundwork New Orleans, which is Groundwork USA is a national group of trusts in individual cities, Richmond included, that empower black youth to green and improve their neighborhoods. And this Groundwork New Orleans produced this kind of solar-powered rainwater harvesting shade structure for bus stops in New Orleans, in a couple bus stops. And so, you know, when we think about like what are sorts of the projects that we can be doing, it is literally supporting the community organizations that are already doing this work. And so I do think here in Richmond, we had a huge, you know, outpouring of support for like the community bail fund when, you know, the protests broke out or demonstrations were occurring after the murder of George Floyd. And so, like, I think that there's a large group of people that truly do care. I do think that but whether or not, as to your point, Gus, is have we felt that pain enough to really focus our work on it? I don't know that. But I do know that in the transit world, in housing, and in green spaces, you know, we have several groups and organizations that truly are centering this work to ameliorate these differences, at least in the built environment. For example, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, which is, you know, historically a predominantly white organization, it just received a grant to support some nonprofits, community-led nonprofits in Southside Richmond, to do some depaving and tree planting. So that's, you know, in my mind, that's an organization really showing that they're willing to put forth the effort to garner funding from a federal agency. This is from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to serve the black community that has been disproportionately exposed to extreme heat. The Science Museum of Virginia, we're about to announce we were awarded a grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to include community members envisioning and building real climate resilient landscapes in their neighborhoods. So I think that there are groups that are making this part of their mission to center communities and use their power and privilege to center these communities in these projects as they move forward. So, but it, does that mean that it's the kind of wholesale, amount of people that probably need to be a part of this in order to really make change happen? I don't know about that outside of the city of Richmond, and I think that we're making a lot of positive progress. I think it's also important though, Gus, like to say that we made progress isn't good enough. We have to demand more. And I'm here for it.
Along with the word separate, progress is another one of those terms. With the term racism, I would definitely put parentheses around. That's even, I would say, the word progress, like it is a metaphor unless we're very specific about what it is that we're trying to obtain, because then we can accurately judge progress. I think that word gets thrown around frequently in the system of racism, white supremacy, and the problems do not get solved.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Gus. And I appreciate that. Again, I'm still learning. And so my vernacular and the way that I describe things probably isn't as detailed as it should be. And so in the sense of progress, you know, funding dollars or trees planted or jobs created or teens, you know, supported in schools, I hear you. And yeah, that wasn't a very good word to choose at that particular description.
It is very common. President Obama uses the word progress. It's very, very common in the way we are, I think, conditioned to think about this problem. Anything else with progress, we would have exact parameters on what it is that we are trying to accomplish here. I guess one major point is just when I look at things in total, even, trying to process your answer to that last question, I look at things on the macro level. I think we just left the Paris Accord, unless I'm in error. The Paris Climate Accord, sorry. And I guess folks could say, hey, we got an election coming up in November, and if we have a change in administration, then maybe that could be reversed. Maybe so. Could have the same administration, so it could just be more the same. But we left the Paris Climate Accord. You have a lot of people who don't even think that there is such a thing as climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it, whichever words people want to use. There are a lot of folks who aren't even convinced that that is a real thing. And even beyond, with regards to racism, white supremacy, there seems to be a lot of evidence that I think President Trump just came out and said, we're not even going to have this white privilege, put that in quotes, training, in federal jobs. We're not going to talk about that and just blaming white people and making them feel bad for things that have happened before. We're not even going to do any of that anymore. I don't see that same zeal when we talk about redlining and how white people deliberately and for decades aggressively went about the business of piling black people into these dilapidated areas where now they have all these health problems and intense heat. I don't see that same commitment from white people, even after reading, like, this was your this report was in the New York Times, so they were talking about your work in these maps and such. I don't see that same zeal and commitment and dedication from white people, like, yes, we are going to get out here and solve these problems, and not just progress. We're going to get this done, like, ASAP. Let's put a date and time on this, like, bam, we're going to have this checked out. We're not going to come 2030 and have the same type of thing come up and black people are dying disproportionately. Like, I just don't see that at all. That's why it kind of rings to me like, wow, I'm not convinced that white people are going to read or see your work and take action to end racism. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, knowing, what's somewhat of like a, the redlining maps were drawn in the 1930s and 40s. But much of what was already there, it wasn't so much that redlining caused the type of, neighborhood built environment that we see today. In fact, when we look at like the environmental descriptors, of these neighborhoods that were written down as in the original notes, by the assessors performing the redlining maps, we see the most common words in C and D neighborhoods. These were the ones that were predominantly black and brown and poor immigrant communities, that these areas were paved, hot, and then the A and B areas, which traditionally were kind of wealthier white communities, they were described as wooded and tree lined. And so even 80 years ago, these neighborhoods were significantly different than one another. And what redlining did was basically make it law that these things continue, and resources denied, and so what I'm kind of getting at is that decisions, whatever decision we make right now, the decisions that we make right now can have echoing, reverberating impacts for the next 80 years. And so I don't claim to know what the right path is. And I would, my personal work has been trying to listen to what communities really want and work with the people that have worked with them in the past to really big impact. And so I don't know, seeing the reports and news coverage of our paper has been really, professionally gratifying. However, this goes back to you too, it's what you said earlier, Gus, is like, did I just do a thing that most white researchers do, is to point out the bad thing and then not do anything? You know, it's like I'm so fearful of being someone that creates knowledge but then does nothing with that knowledge. And I think that's really what science is good for, is that we discover these things and we can use that information to direct and inform our decisions. So I really do hope that whatever it is, and I hope that it's centered in the idea that people that were left out of the room or not around the table are the ones that get the first seats, and all the rest of us, leave the room. And the decisions that are made can reverberate for the next 80 to 100 years or even more. Because, as you mentioned, we don't have, a lot of time to continue, pushing back cutting carbon emissions. Because what's really the heat island stuff existed even without climate change. Without heat waves getting longer and stronger, there would still be this urban heat island disparity in our cities. So add on top of this disparity in our city, add on top of that longer and stronger and more frequent heat waves, it's only going to get worse. So the longer we choose to not address any of these things, and continually just study it and, talk about it and those sorts of things, is real time that people are spending in pain. And personally, that's not something that I can, sit idly by with. So that's why, a lot of the work that we've been trying to do around the city of Richmond is centered on these community green spaces and really, trying to expand that. It's like, as a scientist, I can explain it and I can talk to people and get them excited about using science to enrich their lives. And I hope that, I have at least contributed to a positive outcome for even one person. That would be a win versus people that actively, say that this isn't occurring and it doesn't disproportionately affect people. So anyway, I know that's just a rambling answer, but realistically, I don't know what the right pathway forward is. And I'm more than willing to listen and learn from you, Gus, and folks around the country and around the city of Richmond to help, let's at least just get started. we need to get moving.
Do you have any, suspicion or fears that the COVID-19 and the detrimental impact that that's having on budgets across the world, that might derail some of the plans for the park development or green space development, at least in Richmond?
Well, what's really interesting about, kind of COVID recovery and sort of, green recovery, where we're increasing resilience to climate stressors through infrastructure investments and that sorts of thing. I do think that there is the risk that funding in particular programs might be decreased. There's always that risk. And it really is then it's a question of like, how do people value what's left? And can we, you know, still have those sorts of really impactful things go on? I mean, it's certainly that's way above my pay grade, Gus, but, you know, I will continue to volunteer my time to build parks and plant trees and help out these community organizations that seek to serve, inequitably exposed communities.
See, we had a hand up. The Black African, much obliged for, I think he had to call in a couple times. Thank you for your patience, sir. The Black African, if you had a question for Dr. Hoffman, you should be with us, sir.
Thank you, Gus. So I apologize. I called in maybe like 3 or 4 times, so I'm not sure how the program has gone, or I'm not sure if the questions that I'm about to ask have been asked. I was curious about, I have 2 questions. I was curious about white people in terms of parks, like park spaces, and then like animals. How can I put this? Do white people, why do white people pretend as if they care about the environment or like animals and things like that? Like, because it seems like they don't, but then they, or it seems like you don't, but then people come on shows and things like this and they act like as if they care about the environment. So, and about animals. I'm just wondering, like, is that just to deceive black people?
Well, that's, I'm certainly, I can't speak for every white person by any stretch of the imagination. But I grew up, and this is just from my experience, I grew up fishing in the northwestern part of Wisconsin with my dad. And, he taught me, to value the natural world and make observations of the natural world. I learned how much rain had fallen from the depth of the lake as, represented by the lines of where the water was on this big boulder that was out in the middle of the lake. And it turns out that that boulder was put there at the end of the last ice age as the, ice sheets and glaciers were receding back into Canada. And that's how I got into paleoclimatology, which showed me that the current way that we, and at least, the Western civilization has disproportionately, created carbon emissions that are changing the climate. I don't know. Personally, I don't think, I feel that I truly, value the environment and really dedicated to its preservation. So I can only speak to myself for that. And I appreciate your question, the Black African, because I think in many ways there's a lot of evidence for other individuals that is contrary to that. So I don't have a good answer.
That you care about. Do you think that you care about, like, spaces because, like, I don't know, were there a lot of black people in that part of Wisconsin? Do you think you appreciated it because, like, there weren't a lot of, like, non-white black people there?
No, I think I valued it, one, because I got to experience, the natural environment with my father and, get to see a wild space that hadn't been it hadn't been changed all that much through time. And so I don't think it was at all motivated by, a particular population being there or not being there. I do feel that I care very deeply about these places and spaces.
And like my, I guess my second question is, do you, because you, you said that you're a geologist. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure what that, but I think I'm, like, what do you know about the planet? Like, is it a living thing? Do things, does everything grow? Like, I'm curious about, like, does silicon grow? Does gold grow?
Yeah.
I'm asking because a lot of white people, so-called economists, they use terms like scarcity. So I'm curious if these things grow, then they can't be scarce because it's like trees or whatever, or grass, they grow. So I'm curious if, like, especially, yeah. I don't know if they're called heavy metals or whatever, like gold, silicon, those kinds of things.
Yeah. I love that question. I love that you asked me that question, honestly, because as a geologist and an earth scientist, you know, everything around us is in, you know, some constant state of flux. You know, all of what our bodies, the planet, stars in the sky are all made out of the same things. And in a sense, I mean, in the biological sense, like the growing of a plant, you know, is, you know, the conversion of, you know, photons and sugar and oxygen or carbon dioxide and oxygen and water into sugar. Whereas like minerals and things like that do grow, but not in the same manner. You know, for example, there's this giant cave in Mexico that has these large crystals in it that basically are only in that place. But it's the very specific conditions of this cave that give rise to these very large gypsum crystals. And so, yeah, I think, I mean, in many ways, the things that are around us grow in a lot of different ways. It's maybe just not the same thing as like photosynthesis. To your question about like scarcity, I think that there's something about the then, you know, human use of those things around us. So like, and I'm getting way outside of my expertise here when I'm talking about scarcity. But the idea of like, you know, there's a certain amount of oil in the ground. There's a certain number of trees that are available, or that are growing right now. And so scarcity implies some sort of like natural amount of them, right? And if we use too many of them to create paper or paper towels or wood to build houses, you know, that if that's not replenishing itself, if we're using too many faster than there can be, you know, the replenishment of those natural resources, then I think that's what they're getting at. But I'm way outside of my expertise when we're talking about things like scarcity. So, but to your point, like the whole planet is in some way or another moving and shifting and changing all around us all the time. It's just whether or not we can perceive it happening. So thank you for your question.
Did you? Oh, he answered. You didn't have any more? You just had those two, the Black African?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Much obliged. Great, both questions, great. The first question, at first, it's like, what kind of, the question about why do white people pretend or make it seem as though they really care about the environment? Are they doing it just to confuse black people? And I was kind of like, oh, wow, you know, why would he ask that? Then I stopped for a second. I said, oh, wait a minute, get it together, Gus. Bubbly Creek, like I could have cited a whole lot of things. They just had a report on NPR yesterday, Sunday morning, space debris buildup could threaten satellites, space travel. I don't think black people are responsible for that. But anywho, Bubbly Creek, as someone familiar with the Chicago area, you know Bubbly Creek, Dr. Hoffman?
I don't know it off the top of my head. I feel like I should, but I think it's a river in the west side of Chicago.
A toxic dump, I think might be more accurate, but Yes, we talked about it extensively. I've never lived in Chicago. I've been there a couple times, but I didn't, you know, I'm not a buff on Chicago landmarks and geography. But Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's Packing Them In, she talks about environmental racism. It's in the title of the book, but she talks about how they concentrated black people in the south end of Chicago and how they dumped just all the waste and byproducts from the meatpacking industry and all the other industrial waste. They just dumped it in the river in Bubbly Creek, and it continues to bubble to this day. And they get the same thing where they have lots of reports like, oh, my gosh, it's been toxic and acidic and you can't get in it and no wildlife and all. Literally, it bubbles to the surface because there's so much the toxicity in the water, and it's been like that for so long. But they have campaigns where they're trying to go out and clean it up and what have you. But, I mean, that would be the type of example that I think that he's referencing to, where it's like, wow, white people will come out and do all this to make it seem like they really care about the environment, and then we got on Earth, Bubbly Creek, and all the rest, and then even in space. Space debris buildup could threaten satellites, space travel. Does that, just to add a little bit more, just to make sure we're not being hyperbolic, you do see this. It doesn't seem like white people have been tremendous custodians of the planet, Dr. Hoffman.
Well, I think that there's also, anywhere that we can, identify, where resources have gone and completely debilitated the natural environment. I mean, I think there's so many examples of what, what the caller brought up, the black African, and what you're saying right now. I guess I hadn't thought about it like that. It's a very illuminating, line of thought for sure. My dad grew up in Gage Park, Chicago, which is southwest of, Bubbly Creek. I'll have to ask him, about that. I mean, I know he used to go fishing on the Fox River, which probably even at that time wasn't advisable, somewhere nearby. I mean, Chicago is just a fascinating case study in all of these sorts of topics that we're bringing up, including, how entire ecosystems can be forever changed by the actions of just a few smaller entities or even individual people.
Absolutely. Fascinating. That's why we've covered it so many times on the program. I'll give out the number one more time. Folks have a question they want to sneak in the last few moments that we have. Cool. Dr. Hoffman with us, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question that you'd like to get in for Dr. Hoffman, our guest. He's been visiting with us for the evening. Did I miss, was that the black African or... Okay, thought I missed. That's when I spoke up. Make sure I get in. You in your report, and this is just one thing I note with a number of both white and non-white authors. Again, we're reading Cased, Isabel Wilkerson, The Origins of Our Discontents, book club this Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. She doesn't use the word racism in that book either. She uses the term cased. You in your report use the term historically codified inequities when talking about redlining and some of these other policies. Was that a conscious decision to not use racism or historically codified inequities? Did that seem like a better term to describe what was happening with the housing situation?
Yeah, because the idea is that it was like a law, and like codifying, meaning like an actual like almost like de jure kinds of segregation. In the same way. So it wasn't necessarily left out for any particular reason other than we were trying to be as specific as we could as to like what this thing really was in the sense of a framework or a law. That's the only reason we referred to it as historically codified inequity. But yeah, I mean, like you're right. I mean, like all one has to do is read the kinds of descriptions of the people that were living in these areas. Here in Richmond, for example, Gus is like Jackson Ward, Newtown East or Newtown West, and Carver were, you know, the only word to describe the inhabitant was Negro. On the other side of town, just a couple miles away, Windsor Farms, which is, you know, predominantly white and extremely wealthy today, their inhabitant was described as the best people. So, I mean, they were saying the quiet part out loud in the notes of these redlining maps.
That is one thing I often appreciate about some of those older statutes, and that's all across the country, all across the world, really. But here in Seattle, they had similar reports where you can go back and you can see the explicit raw language. Sometimes it'll say it flagrantly. No niggers. They'll have it in there that plain.
Right.
Make it plain. It could have been historically codified racism. That would have made your point about, because that is important, right? This is not just, you know, some people getting together in the backyard and saying, you know, we're not going to rent to black. Like, this is law. Like, you will get in trouble. This is what the statutes are, blah, 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 so that this can be self-perpetuating for decades. But, I mean, still, that would be historically codified racism, white supremacy. And I just point that out because that's so consistent where white people in particular, and really in my view, that's one of the ways that the system of white supremacy is maintained, how white people practice racism. They deliberately use incorrect terms. There'll be a lot of pussyfooting. That's how we have microaggressions and white privilege, marginalizing, lots of these terms that get away from, as I said, Beryl Satter. It's racism, and she said it's economic terrorism when you do this to people and have them fearful if they walk out of this neighborhood, something's going to happen to them and all the rest of it. Calling things by their proper name is a huge component of white supremacy racism, something I point out on the broadcast on a pretty regular basis. Let's see, the person who dialed in, last four digits, 9401. Did you have a question for Dr. Jeremy Hoffman?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. My question is, Dr. Hoffman, who do you think is most responsible for the pollution on this planet?
There's objective evidence, you know, that like very few. Well, there's, you know, real strong evidence that, you know, only a handful, you know, 100 companies or something like that are responsible for most of the carbon emissions. But it depends on how you define pollution, I guess. I'm assuming you're saying carbon dioxide. There's a recent paper that particulate matter is predominantly produced by white communities, but disproportionately experienced by black and brown communities. So, I think it in many ways points to a small portion of the global populace, predominantly Western cultures, that tend to be the ones that are using more resources than others.
And what do you mean by Western culture? What's the racial classification of people from Western culture?
Yeah, so I mean, like I said in the report of, you know, particulate matter, which is a very serious pollutant, especially for respiratory illnesses and things like that, it's predominantly white people that are producing pollutant in the materials and, you know, driving and those sorts of things. Americans, by and large, I mean, I guess I don't know off the top of my head, like, what the racial breakdown in, you know, carbon emissions, but I would suspect that they're very much the same, and where, you know, white communities, white people are more responsible than others for some, at least it depends on the pollutant, of course. But again, I think if you're meaning something like carbon dioxide or particulate matter, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, you know, it's predominantly white communities that are responsible for it per capita. Because even that is something that goes into those calculations.
Can I ask another question, Gus?
Oh, sure, sure.
I was going to ask you, do you think, because you're a white person, correct? You're a white person, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you think, I think you're talking about climate change, do you think that that issue that you're talking about is important to white people collectively?
Collectively is such a, like, I mean, to me it is, and I can like really only, I appreciate, like, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm speaking for, you know, an entire, you know, group of the population, but I do think personally, to me, it is very, very important to understand that difference.
I only asked because I assumed that you were around other white people, so you would have conversations with other white people, and you would know, I guess, of some kind of idea of what they feel or what they think about climate change and how important it is to them. So just that's why I asked that question. But thank you for answering my questions.
Yeah, thank you for asking. And I mean, the my friends and colleagues, you know, that work in climate change, you know, I mean, I think I'm very blessed to have friends that truly value that difference. You know, but yeah, I appreciate your question, and it's very well taken. Thank you.
Okay. Do you get the sense that there are a number of white people, as I said, who either don't believe in this or don't think it's that big a deal, like kind of how we started out, like, yeah, maybe this might be a problem, but it's only going to be a problem like 1,000 years from now. It might be, you know, way too hot and that type of thing, but not anything that's going to impact me in my lifetime. Do you get a sense that a lot of white people don't really?
I think in general, you know, we're seeing more and more evidence that people, you know, I mean, there's this thing called the Yale Climate Opinion Maps, and it's basically, you know, a survey of a couple thousand people asking certain questions about climate change, and, you know, a majority of people, and I don't know what the exact numbers are off the top of my head, but again, it's like 60-70% of people now agree that, you know, climate change is occurring. What the thing that we don't associate it with is that it's occurring to me. And, you know, and it's not happening to me, you know, it's happening to others or somewhere far away or sometime not now. So I do think that there's still a huge disconnect between people acknowledging that it's an issue and then understanding its relationship to their lives. Now, for the white communities, you know, and especially because we know that they're not as exposed to, you know, climate stressors in cities, you know, I haven't seen any sort of studies and wouldn't want to, you know, hand wave or speculate, but I imagine, you know, the fact that they're in climate resilience studies, we talk about the idea of adaptive capacity. And so the idea that people have the resources or have the ability to reduce their vulnerability to a particular stressor through adaptive capacity in the sense of like climate change, it'd be something like being able to run your air conditioning. You know, Gus, we were talking earlier about the ability to have and the privilege of having air conditioning, is had by wealthier people. That tend to be white communities. So is it so much that there's this adaptive capacity disparity as well? And so that allows folks, you know, to consider it something that's not going to impact them. And I think about it in the context of extreme heat. But, you know, people that live on the coast here in Virginia, we have the highest rate of sea level rise on the entire East Coast of North America, or at least one of the fastest. And so, you know, communities across the Virginia coast are dealing with the effects of a rising rising sea level, including, you know, just last week or few days ago, you know, we had Hurricane last weekend, not this past one, but the one before it. Hurricane Sally caused a huge storm surge among also then, you know, a astronomically high tide. So, you know, people that are experiencing different climate stressors might report different levels of that kind of like awareness of it going on. But certainly, you know, the idea, I mean, I think about Hurricane Katrina or any of the climate disasters that disproportionately impact communities of color for a longer time period after the event occurs, like for the city of Chicago, even the heat wave, that I suspect, you know, that these two communities, or white people and black people in communities of color, would say different things about their perceived like risk. I was just introduced to a scholar at the University of or North Carolina State University, Louis Rivers, who's worked in understanding how communities perceive risk. And it's fascinating when you actually just ask people what they think about, you know, what they want to see happen in their community, what they fear about, you know, all those things. Very rarely does climate kind of reach the top of the list, but things like beautification and, you know, workforce development, those sorts of things are climate adjacent. If you can kind of have and open those conversations up to be localized and framed in the historical context, and going back to your context of, you know, things like redlining being one of the things that provides that kind of background.
Context of white supremacy. Wow. I guess with that, I live in Seattle. As I said, they are super green focused, green dedicated. They have bikes every here and green transportation and solar panels and all the rest of it. I mean, super green and, you know, all ways that you can imagine. It also does seem like, as I said, the current president, I think we did leave the Paris Climate Accord. It does seem like there's some dissension, some disagreement where maybe they're experiencing it differently, so they have a different opinion about how serious it is, and or some folks, it seems like they have said that they, you know, they're not convinced. They don't. Maybe it's happening. Maybe the climate's changing. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's man-made climate change. Maybe it's not. But yeah, it seems, at least our current president would give the impression that there's not a unanimous school of thought about this thing.
Yeah, and I think you know a lot of what, you know, climate communication research suggests is that, like, you know, I think for some people, you know, it, instead of it kind of being like, do you or do you not agree with climate change happening, it's like where can we agree, you know, on things and the shared values that we might have to address these things. But yeah, I mean, I think it was made official that we did leave the Paris Accord. So, I think you're right about that. And hopefully, you know, I mean, even without the federal leadership, there are a lot of states and localities that are doing a lot. California just announced that they're not going to have any more internal combustion engine cars. And like the state of Virginia, we have the Virginia Clean Economy Act. And so even without, you know, very, very, you know, forceful federal leadership, which I still think is absolutely necessary, in order for us to achieve our role in carbon emissions reductions, there is promising, action being taken. Is it enough? No, but we can celebrate, small steps while demanding big leaps.
The Black African, did you have a question before Dr. Hoffman departs?
Yeah, I had one question. I just listening to you talking about the climate change and what. I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times or something like that, where I guess so-called energy companies, like oil companies, it was saying that they had sort of sponsored sort of like a deception campaign where they were saying that basically like plastics are recyclable. So basically that the article was pretty much saying that the whole recycling thing in the U.S. is basically a lie, that most of these plastics are not recyclable. Or if they are recyclable, they're only recyclable like once, and there's very few of those, and that and that the whole recycling thing had been like a deception campaign to make people feel good or feel okay about using plastics. I'm wondering how do we, mostly black people, how do we, when things like that are occurring, like while they're occurring, how do I decipher that like white people are engaging in a deception campaign?
Well, that's, the idea that, personal responsibility is like the route to fixing our climate problem or our trash problem or anything like that has, been linked with very large scale misinformation campaigns, that follow kind of the same playbooks. Kind of manufactured by the companies that were creating the plastic bottles. So the idea that it wasn't so much the kind of system's responsibility to respond, but instead yours, and all the blame is now squarely on you to not be a litter bug. But really, could there have been an alternative to plastics, at least in sort of like consumables? And then now, there's been evidence to suggest that, energy companies, oil companies, came up with that idea of like a carbon footprint and understanding how big your carbon footprint is something that puts the blame on you to change your lifestyle, personally. And it takes, everyone contributing. And if there's nothing there, from the systems level that addresses those things, then how is anybody supposed to know? And I didn't know. I don't think anybody knew that these deceptions were going on. But what, ultimately, I think, like the idea of trying to think critically about the sources of messages is something that, the ability to see and evaluate an argument, framework called FLIC, and I forget what the exact so science denial takes on kind of like five general techniques, and my colleague John has kind of identified these, and it's like the idea of fake experts, so like putting two people in the room. And one person that doesn't really have any real expertise in that issue, talking to you about it. So like me talking about economics, I don't have any expertise in that. So, take all that, what I said about economics with a grain of salt. But then there's also like logical fallacies. So the idea that, a premise or a conclusion does not follow from a particular number of premises, impossible expectations, like moving a goalpost, like you're never quite going to satisfy the level of rigor that someone needs in order to understand. And like cherry picking, the idea of selectively highlighting data points or data sets that only confirm your worldview, that's a very common technique to deny scientific information, is to choose just one case or an anecdote that defends your worldview versus the litany of scientific information that might go on beyond that. And then ultimately conspiracy theories, the idea that there's like some, shadowy cabal of something going on in the background. Those kind of common techniques of science denial are things that we can all train ourselves to see, hear, and identify and internalize it. So, I think in some ways it's like educating yourself about these sorts of techniques of science denial learning how to identify when someone is not having a good faith scientific argument. And, like the carbon footprint thing, if we were to like kind of, look at that, maybe it's a logical fallacy in that your small individual carbon footprint is one of, a few billion footprints out there. And unless all the footprints are moving in the same direction, then it's not going to change. So in some ways, like if I had known about like this kind of science denial framework, I could have come to that conclusion myself. Then again, that's just like one thing that like, the way of identifying a deception, especially a scientific one, boils down to those kinds of like five common techniques: fake experts, logical fallacies, impossible expectations, cherry picking, and conspiracy theories. So that's the best I can do for you, Black African, and I appreciate that question.
Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, the Black African. Before we let you enjoy the rest of your Monday evening, has any component of chatting with us here on the Cows this evening been uncomfortable for you as a white man, Dr. Hoffman?
Absolutely, Gus, yeah. I mean, I think, I'm learning all the time about these, what you were saying earlier, like these coded messages that that really, like, I'm saying the quiet part, I'm saying the loud part quietly, by using coded language, and so thereby upholding my power in the situation. And I think understanding where those things are in my life, yeah, it makes me feel uncomfortable, but like, I'm so thankful for having this conversation with you. It's really, really thankful for the perspective of your callers. And I think that their questions were very, challenging and required me to think on my feet and defend, choices and word choices. I mean, it really does come down to like how willing am I to confront racism in the world around me, even as a scientist that tries to use, these flowery language combinations, but those are coded. And so, I was uncomfortable at a few points, but I hope, I hope that I was able to explain the scientific nature of our work. And, I hope your listeners found it a valuable experience to listen to. And, I certainly would look forward to the next time I get to talk to you, Gus.
For sure. I learned a lot as well. I guess on the way out, our mom in Michigan always asks, who do you think is more confused about racism, meaning lacking an accurate understanding of what racism is and how it works? Do you think white people are more confused about racism, or do you think non-white people are more confused?
White people, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, all righty. We have been chatting it up with Dr. Jeremy S. Hoffman, live from Virginia. The Coon Man, they just said Governor Ralph Northam and his wife tested positive for COVID-19. Can you believe it? What a year it has been. I learned a ton reading and just chatting this evening, but I learned quite a bit just reading your research. I was ignorant, not my subject matter, climate change and all that with the intense heat, but wow. I'm so glad I read it and glad we had a chance to speak with you this evening. I will do more research. Dr. Daron Chavez, I'll check him out once we get off the air and continue to do my homework. Thank you so much for chatting with us, Dr. Hoffman.
Great. Thank you so much, Gus. It was an absolute pleasure. Have a great Monday evening.
I will try. Thank you, sir. Context of White Supremacy. Again, that was Dr. Jeremy S. Hoffman joining us live from Virginia. Get my Facebook page so I can get it. He's at the L. Douglas Wilder. Where's my Facebook page at so I can get the full correct title for his position? We were just talking about former Governor Wilder just like days ago. We talked about him a number of times over the years, but like literally just days ago, because John Thompson had just passed, and they were talking about Allen Iverson, and yep, would not have been. We probably wouldn't even know his name if it had not been for Governor Wilder, the first Black governor in Virginia, Governor Wilder. Here we go. So, yes, I'm sure I give out the full title of his position, Virginia Commonwealth. It is the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs at Virginia Commonwealth University, VCU. There we go. For folks who, if you maybe just started listening to the Cows in the past year, 2 years or so, you weren't here when Beryl Satter was a guest on the program. You should listen to the program and read the book. It has a lot of great information. It's like specifically focused on Chicago, but it applies nationally, at least in the U.S. And in, when she was a guest on the program, we talked about how it applied nationally. But lots of great information there. N.D.B. Connolly, A World More Concrete. You should definitely read the book. If you are a resident in Florida, you should own the book. Lots of great info, and he was a guest in 2015. You should check out that visit to the program. We covered quite a bit of material then as well. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, Packing Them In, The History of Environmental Racism in Chicago. That's what we covered. Bubbly Creek specifically, since that got mentioned, she talked about it so extensively in Packing Them In. This is her quote from the Chicago Tribune, October 27, 1909. The quote reads, "There, the flow of the river, which had always been sluggish, practically stopped with the reversal of the flow in the river's main channel. Bubbly Creek became a practically stagnant pool. The refuse poured into it was not carried away. It putrefied and filled in the bed of the river at the rate of almost half a foot a year from 1895 to 1908. It created a scum on the water's surface through which the putrescent gases forming below with difficulty found their way to give the creek its name." Bushnell's contemporary description noted that the south branch of the Chicago River, just north and northwest of the stockyards, had become so polluted that small animals and fowls make their way across the river upon its coating of filth and grease. This is no hyperbole, right? So all this 1908, when we were reading the book, they have video right now, 2020, of the lake still bubbling, excuse me, river, still bubbling right now, and talking about trying to fix it. Like, man, that I can't believe even for 3 seconds when the black African asked that question about, man, white people pretending that they care about all, Bubbly Creek still bubbling 100 years. Remember when we read all that? I was being truthful. I'm no, you know, buff on Chicago geography or anything like that, and I had never heard of Bubbly Creek till we read Packing Them In, and then talked about it with Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington when she came to visit with us on Earth Day this year. But yeah, like, in addition to the debris in outer space, again, I don't think O.J. Simpson, is he friends with Elon Musk? Are they hanging out in outer space and, you know, littering as they go, throwing things out the spacecraft as they, you know, check out Venus and all the rest? Is that happening? I thought they said we just talked about them claiming Venus. Did O.J. Simpson or Al Sharpton, did they claim a planet, launch a satellite? Did I miss that? Anywho, my apologies to the live listening folks. I made an error with the audio, so it wasn't going out to the folks who were on the phone line. So some folks, I think, got confused and hung up and all the rest. It was broadcasting on the live stream, but I saw it after we'd been on for a little bit and then switched it over, so it worked. That's how we got callers toward the end, but I fear we lost some of the live callers just because I made a mistake. My bad. Victim of white supremacy. I will do better on Wednesday. We should have Dr. Sarah Hercula. I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Hercula. It's got to be it, Hercula. Or I'll double check when she gets here. But she is a white woman. She does research on the use of words. We talked about that today. Language is so critical in how the system of white supremacy is maintained and correct use of words to replace that system, decode that system, really. But that's what some of her work looks at. A little differently, she looks at the component of how non-white people will be mistreated because they don't speak the King's English and that type of thing. Obviously want to do more with just words in general, but that'll be Wednesday. Dr. Sarah Hercula will be with us normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Let's see. Any of the folks who are with us, any thoughts, observations? Again, my bad if it was, you know, difficult, cumbersome, if you weren't able to hear the earlier portion of the broadcast, if you feel like you missed out, the archive should be pristine. But folks who dialed in with us, any thoughts, observations, comments to share what they heard?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, cool. Yeah, I called in like around 8:40 something and I couldn't hear anything. And I kept on calling in, and I think around like 9 o'clock or so, I finally got to hear the conversation. I had one more question to ask him. And my question was, why is it that Western European culture have an objectifying relationship with nature and earth? I was very curious to hear his response. Isn't that it? Yeah, and even though we're talking about, I think that we're talking about the U.S., but like globally, like white people just make a mess. As you said, they're not very good custodians of the earth. They make a mess globally. I think the other day they were talking about plastic being in Kenya, and just like they just send their garbage all over the planet. And you're talking about even out of space, like they have passed the planet. But yeah, that's all I have to share. Thank you.
My bad for the first 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever it was. That was my fault. Pressed the wrong button. Didn't realize it until we had got, you know, a bit down the road. Glad I saw it then. But the archive, as I said, should, you know, be fine. Give a hoot. Give a yell. If you're already with us and you had another question, because I definitely would have, you know, asked him if we could have got in another one before he departed. But yeah, just give a hoot, give a yell, or what have you. And yeah, I always try to see if we can sneak, you know, last question or questions if folks have something. I would have been curious to hear his thoughts on that one. Like I said, just, you know, that is so important because white people, if they really wanted to, like, oh man, they could get credit. I think they said they had the electric car like 70 years ago. If they were really serious, like, hey, we are going to take care of this, but we're not throwing around plastic everywhere. And, you know, that is a disgrace. Folks talking about their E.T. come to the planet and he can't even get here because there's so much litter out. And but come on. Come on. We're not going to do that. We're going to take care. They could have done that a long time ago. Bubbly Creek. They're not interested in that. That's not what. Yes. So glad the black African got that question in. Bubbly Creek. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
I think, I think his answer to the first question that I asked, when he was talking about his dad, and them enjoying nature, I think when I asked him, like, did he enjoy it because, you know, there were no black people, I think that's a legitimate question, because I've seen it, like, where, you know, they'll kill whole people or they'll do something and then they'll turn it into like a nature reserve or something like that. Then they get to enjoy it, and black people are not allowed to go there and enjoy it. And I've seen it even in like my own little residence. There's a park here, a pretty large one. It has like a lake, but for a really long time I didn't know about it. And then whenever I go there, just usually like white people and like non-black people. So, yeah. And I also think like he was practicing deception about my second question, like about, like if he's a geologist, I feel like my question was kind of direct. Like I was asking about, like, I think I asked about gold and silicon. And he didn't really want to go. He talked about crystals and other stuff. So I think he was practicing deception because he should know it because he's a geologist. So he should know about such material. Thank you.
PhD geologist, specialty in paleoclimatology, yes. I would say in general, be suspicious. Any white person who, I'm not an expert on racism. I'm trying to learn, and learning from you non-white people, be suspicious. I mean, if you have research published in the New York Times, you're not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. And I mean, you've got access to the redlining maps and N.D.B. Connolly's work and all the rest of it. Like, again, you cannot be a white person and be ignorant about racism. He said that, got that question in at the end. How many white guests have we've had on who said, oh yeah, white people are the ones who are ignorant about racism? How did they get all these codified laws in about where the Negro can live? And especially this program, connect this with Harriet A. Washington, medical apartheid too, but A Terrible Thing to Waste, environmental racism and how it's impacting the brain. Because that and packing them in, she talks so much about the intentionality, the deception, lying, putting black people in these areas where you know it's asbestos, where you know it's content. Remember in A Terrible Thing to Waste, she talked about it was for Baltimore because she talked about Freddie Gray and a number of cases there, but she talked about how they would lie. They would do experiments. We're going to move black people to a specific residence house where we know it's contaminated. We know it's got, you know, foul, whatever. We already know that, and we're not going to tell them, and then we can experiment. We can study the impact of lead exposure on black children. That was all. That wasn't an accident. That was, oh, we didn't know lead. No. Deliberate white supremacy, racism. A Terrible Thing. It's the reason that book is in my top 10. A Terrible Thing to Waste. Absolutely fantastic. We were reading it right this year with when the Rona came on, right? I think right going into spring. Anywho. But yeah, that, be mindful. Anytime you talk to a white person and they say they are ignorant about racism, be mindful. Never, at least I say, you should never think that you're talking to a white person who's ignorant about racism, particularly if they're publishing books and giving talks, lectures and things like that where they get to talk about racism. Absolutely not. You are talking to like an expert on what this problem is. All of that said, I did think that was super important about the health impact. Like I literally just had that conversation with a black female about the health implications of all that high heat. You have a lot of black people, they might not have air conditioning, and particularly this year, because they were saying this past summer you couldn't go to the movie theater to get in if you don't have air conditioning at home. Why? The Rona. Hold, they have, I guess in some places, it's been a long time since I've been in hot areas, but they have like cooling centers, same type of thing. You can go there and they'll have AC so you can escape the heat a little bit. All that, or a lot of those types of facilities have been closed or compromised because of the Rona. Public libraries, same thing. That would be another one where you could go to escape the heat. It's been closed because of the Rona. Like, that has serious health ramifications a lot of times for black people, especially if you have high blood pressure. She talked about that in A Terrible Thing to Waste. If you have high blood pressure, if you're obese, you have asthma and things like that, difficult to get oxygen to your brain. Going to impact your ability to think logically and at a high level. Like, wow, really important, the health implications of that high heat and not having trees, native plants where they just stack you somewhere. Mr. Fuller talked about that. He said if you pay attention, a lot of the content, he said he was just noticing from the patterns that he was seeing on television, a lot of the content that featured black people, it would not have them in areas where they're out at the lake, you know, calm, beautiful, crystal clear water that you can drink, you know. No. We're not going to have them out, you know, hiking, pristine trails, and snow, and, you know, mountain goats, and squirrel runs. But no. We're not going to do that. We're not going to have them out someplace on a beach, you know, no Negroes on the beach. Put them out where it's concrete and glass. You know, light poles, asphalt, big cement buildings, all of that. Get them accustomed to that environment. Maybe some razor wire up around a gated fence or something. That's the environment that we want you to be accustomed to, something that almost looks like a prison because they don't have, you know, trees and bushes and flowers there either. You just got asphalt and bars and cement concrete. That's what we want you to get accustomed to. That's what you're supposed to see on a day. Broken glass, trash, steam, smoke, pollution coming from, you know, the factory over yonder. That's what we want you to experience. And even how he said they've done research, they studied. You walk through that environment and how that impacts you, beyond just, you know, now your lungs are contaminated and all that, but just how that impacts how you feel, you walk through that, as opposed you get to walk through, you're in Virginia, so they got the dogwood trees, a few tulips, get to see a robin, all that as you're walking through. Totally different experience. It is not an accident. All of that is by design in the system of white supremacy, racism. I guess I would submit, just according to the evidence, it would seem white people are not interested in changing that at all. At all. In fact, the evictions, that right there, he mentioned that. He said they're having a rash of evictions in Virginia. If they were really serious about this, how are we going to be evicting people during the Rona? Dedication, that's in the definition. Dedication to white supremacy, racism. I asked him about my definition at the beginning. That'll be in the archives. Let's see. Other folks, again, my bad. Sorry for messing it up. Not having the hitting the correct button promptly. Other folks who dialed in, if you had a question, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
What's up? This is non-Cunston Grad. Unfortunately, I missed the first hour, and then by the time I got back, I tried to call in. Unfortunately, I found that the website was not working, and then I actually had a quick, intelligent talk to actually try to call over the phone and was actually, well, now I'm in. Nevertheless, I wonder if the professor, if anyone got a chance to ask him, or whether did the professor bring up the connection between, for example, the lack of trees in urban areas where black people tend to live, and, for example, car accidents and people getting harmed that way. So, for example, you know, when you have a street that's lined with trees, you know, people, if they do drive off the road, potentially they have a tree to protect them from being harmed from a car running off the road. And I think personally, that's another example of an environment that, you know, basically made to harm black people. So it's not just hot. You don't have any kind of protection from passing by fast traffic. I wonder if any kind of connections like that was made.
Dang, my fault. Would have been great to get sincere with, you know, how they do what they call urban planning and the rest of that. It would have been great to get your thoughts, questions, input. Messed up with, you know, getting the audio on the phone line, at least initially. It took me a while to recognize it wasn't playing there. But, no, he did not address the lack of trees to increased accidents. He certainly talked about not having trees and even just having grass. That is, I thought that was important. Talking about white culture, he was saying the grass that we have here, a lot of it is brought over from Europe, and that doesn't help with lowering the climate either, as opposed to having native species of plants. But yeah, we did not talk about the trees being an added protection for accidents, and that would just, you know, further instill these things are not by accident. White people generally put a lot of thinking. And then you go back, and as you realize problems, you go back, you adjust, you recodify sometimes, you update, you know. But planned, well thought out, well planned in advance to maximize white life, and then they do the exact opposite when it comes to black people. They got trees up to protect their motorists, right, so that they have an accident, preserve life, won't even put a sidewalk in the area where the niggers are. Not by accident. Say that again. Yeah, would have been good to get that question in. Non-Clemson grad. Although I suspect that might have been another one where he would have said, you know, that's not his area of expertise type of thing, but would have at least been good to get his thoughts to that question.
If he would have said that was not his area of expertise, I would have highly suspected that he was lying, because geology is part of the urban planning profession. So the idea that he would not have heard of such a thing, at least not in passing, I just highly doubt that. And like you said, you know, where I live in South Carolina, you know, I have some sidewalks where I live, right? Sometimes I go running, I'm an avid runner, and sometimes I run into the white neighborhoods, and you can really see the demarcation line between the black and the white neighborhoods. For example, once you get into the white neighborhoods, you have curbs and a whole lot more trees, and it just has a different feel and just feels better. Versus when you're walking in the black neighborhood, which I live in, you know, you might have a sidewalk here and there, but you just feel exposed walking along the street. And in places where, you know, there's major thoroughfares, you know, if they do have sidewalks, especially in the summertime, you are just exposed to the sun. And it is very unusual to find someone walking on the sidewalk, even if they are there, and if they are, maybe they have a hat on, maybe they're riding a bike or something, or someone who just can't afford to drive, and they're just doing their best, and, you know, good luck to that person, of course. But, of course, those are the kind of environments, especially at least I find here in the South, those exposed environments to the sun.
Now that we did talk about in detail, because I was stunned. Like, there was, and this wasn't his area of expertise, apparently. There was a New York Times report talking about his research with redlining and the correlation to intense heat. And within the New York Times report, they referenced a different study that talked about how this intense heat impacts mental health. And I was reading some of the details, and he talked about that, which I thought was fascinating, but it related like exactly to what you're talking about. You're outside, we just went through the, you're in South Carolina, so I mean, Jesus Christ, and Charleston was one of the areas that they looked at. But I mean, you're outside and they have this intense heat. If you don't have any trees and it's just asphalt, like we said, or it's just grass, because he said that doesn't lower the temperature either. So if it's grass, asphalt, these big cement buildings, no tree cover, anything like that, all that just holds that heat in. And he said it can be substantial, not just in terms of, oh man, it's hot and burn all the rest, I mean, that's bad enough, but that has an impact on your mental health, which I just was not considering, like in terms of just being there and how you feel having to sit there. If you have to walk through the area or hang out there for a little while, like, can totally change your mood about how you're feeling about life, as opposed to exactly what you said. Now you switch, you get to hang out where the white people are. Shrubs, plants, trees, shade. Oh, he called it natural air conditioning. And I mean, it is, because he said the difference can be substantial. It can be a 5 degree difference, which is enormous. You're talking about going through an area in the summertime where it feels like 95, where it could feel like 85 or 80, like huge, just on those trees and everything, where you can feel better about being outside and enjoy, relax, bring your blood pressure down, all the rest of it. In fact, I mentioned the Kerner Report. They talked about, I think it was almost a matter of cliche, if it's going to be really hot. They would say that if it's going to be a long, hot summer, if it's going to be especially hot, oh, we know it's going to be more riots and things. Some of that is tied to exactly what we're talking about, I think. This is not my area of expertise either. I'm just trying to follow logic. But, I mean, if it's known where it seems almost a science where the hotter it gets, they know at a certain point, more likely to have riots, disturbances, that type of thing. How much of that is because mental health impact of the heat? More likely to be aggressive and lash out, violent even. In fact, like I said, I hadn't even, you know, processed that. But I'm going to see if we can talk to this person. The report, possible biological mechanisms linking mental health and heat. A contemplative review. I think a white person wrote this report from 2018. I'm going to see if we can get him on the program, because I mean, and it's so many different ways, because he was talking about like sleep. You're in that area where you don't have the trees and everything, and he has it in the report. It holds that heat, so at night, even then, the temperature doesn't drop. It's still hot, and he talked about that. So it's at night. Either you got to run the AC all day, all night long. The energy cost with that, or Now you have a difficult time sleeping. Lots of people are not at their best when they're sleep deprived, and I know that happens in the summertime, and I remember that living in Virginia and Atlanta, where they have all that excessive heat in the summertime, it can be really difficult to sleep. Lots of layers, man. Let's see. Other folks, if they had questions, comments,
greeting
to share. Mr. Blue with us as well. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Hope everyone is doing well and staying as healthy as they can during the Rona and this very strange time in human history. Yeah, I caught the program late. I was trying to get on the free conference call. Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you. Yes, sir.
Hello, hello. Okay. My phone just went out. I went on the Black Talk Radio Network and tried to tap the link for the free conference call, HD, and it kept telling me to reload on my phone. So just an FYI, that was kind of strange. So I just had to look for it and go online and then finally just log in, get the free log in and whatever, and now I'm here and I've been able to listen for the past like 45 minutes. So just an FYI, it was little. I don't know if that was the website or if it was just maybe my phone, but normally it worked. It was good listening. Always been in the background listening to the podcast and everything. So it was good to finally hear, listen live and listen to all the wonderful questions asked. And in reference to non-white people being placed in certain areas that white people know are chemically or environmentally unsound, we have had many of those issues in the Bronx, where huge building developments have been placed in areas that used to be swamps, areas that used to be sewage plants. There's a building, very well-known building, off of the highway, the Major Deacon Highway in the Bronx, that was actually placed near and on top of a sewage plant in Manhattan near Riverside Drive. There has been parks that were placed next to sewage plants. In fact, I believe it's a Riverside Park. And when I used to work with children, there was never any trees there. So we would always have to tell the children and the parents that were accompanying us when we would go for trips there to go to the swimming pool or go to play any type of sports, that because of the lack of trees in that area, and also bring extra water because we were suspect of the drinking fountains and the water that was coming out of the drinking fountains, because at that time people were saying that they were getting, their children were feeling kind of woozy or a little nauseous after particularly drinking water from the drinking fountain in that area. And in New York City, we've had many problems and many protests and many things happening because many of the major building complexes that they talk about, oh, it's a new development and this is going to be some place that you can raise family, and it's not the projects per se, but it's these new huge building developments. They have been consistently placed in old sewage plants or near sewage plants, old swamps, swamp areas, swamp land. Even in fact, here in Co-op City in the Bronx, this used to be and was swampland that they placed a huge building, a small city in called Co-op City. And so we've had many issues like that. And so when being suspect, when white people claim ignorance to issues and things that they cause and then want to be regaled for solving the problem of climate and sewage and environmental, it always fascinates me that they would say something that they're ignorant and think and have people think that things haven't been well planned and thought out, particularly when you talk about redlining and things like that. And so I just wanted to say that and say greetings to everyone, and it's good to hear you live again and catch a call. It's been a very rough. Thank you, and I'm mute my line. Thank you, Gus, and thank you to all the callers.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue. It certainly has been a tough calendar year, but I guess for whatever it's worth, we have almost made it through. So hopefully 2020 will be a substantial improvement. Mr. Blue was with us down in the retreat in Florida earlier at the beginning of the year. Seems like 15,000 years ago by now. But absolutely the deliberate nature, talking about the same experiences, black people being deliberately placed in some sort of toxic environment, and you can't even drink the water, much less trees, shrubbery, that type of thing. Can't even be here without, you know, having contaminated water. And then it's what? The water's got what in it? Oh my goodness. You don't say. I don't know how that could happen. Well, maybe once we get the Rona taken care of, we'll see if we can get that water taken care of, cleaned out for you. We'll have to see. The Rona is taking our time and energy right now. Standard. Even I was thinking James Loewen would be added in there as well, although, you know, it's a ton of books already mentioned, but even that one, because it's so standard in terms of deliberately creating areas, and that's the terrorism component. Deliberately creating these exclusively white enclaves that are healthy and not rife with lead and have trees and peach trees and all the rest of it. And then you make sure that the niggers, through threat of violence, do not ever encroach upon your, you know, immaculately manicured property, neighborhoods. Let's see. Did any other folks? That was Mr. Blue and non-Clemson grad that we heard from. Any other questions, thoughts from folks who were able to persevere and hear some of the broadcast? I appreciate the folks who said they had some difficulty dialing in. That has been a number of folks, myself included. Our guest even today, he said he tried to dial in and was blocked. Like I ended up calling him to have him on my line, but he attempted to dial in. He said he was blocked out too and couldn't even make it work. So apparently there has been at minimum widespread difficulty, if not outright interference, for folks trying to call and listen in live. So much obliged to folks persevering and hanging in there to get on the line. I had tried the free HD link myself very recently, and it did work. So I'm not sure if this is like a recent thing where it's, you know, not being troublesome or what have you, but I'll try again after we get off the program. And but yeah, I appreciate folks letting me know. It seems to be a widespread problem where folks are being blocked or dropped or some kind of odd obstructions in trying to access the live broadcast. The archives, again, will be available on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Black Talk Radio Network, YouTube, array of spots. So archives should be full, pristine recording. Any other folks, comments that they wanted to make sure they share?
May I be heard, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Very quickly?
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Kaya just reminded me that a year before the Rona and the coronavirus happening in the United States, Co-op City did have a Legionnaire's disease epidemic going on in small Co-op City. They had to, going through the water system, where we could not drink the water for about a month to 2 months, and we could not take showers, and they gave us strong legislation and rules on how to heat our water and how to take showers so that water would not get into our mouths because of a Legionnaire's disease problem that had been ongoing in Co-op City, and they were trying to finally conquer that problem. Last thing said, so yeah, very interesting.
So embarrassing. That's and consistent, because that was in Flint, Michigan as well, where they had Legionnaires' disease after they had lied to the people and minimized the problem. Standard operating procedure. But we talked about that when we were talking. We did the report on Flint, Michigan, and that ongoing chemical and biological warfare earlier this year. I forgot we had a white guest on the program for that, but she talked about it. Oh, I'm looking at it right now. They had the report on NPR. They had a number. I think we had the report from NPR when they talked about this and a number of other outlets. Let me see. This is from 2018. An outbreak of Legionnaires' disease that killed 12 people and sickened at least 87 in Flint, Michigan in 2014 and 15 was caused by low chlorine levels in the municipal water system. Scientists have confirmed it is the most detailed evidence yet linking the bacterial disease to the city's broader water crisis. It is not just Flint where they're having the lead issue. So as a standard operating procedure, and again, you see the same patterns where they lie about this sort of thing. They couldn't even just come out and tell people honestly what was happening. It was lying. Oh, the water's fine. Shut up. The water's fine. Shut up. Just drink it. Shut up. And then you get through all this. Oh, my Lord, we got Legionnaires' disease. And the children have been ruined for the next, you know, five generations. And hair... Not by accident. Bubbly Creek. Not by accident. You just go. The Cows Book Club this year. Packing them in. A terrible thing to waste. You can just go right down the line. Environmental racism is not by accident. And it's widespread. Everything that we talked about today, just the mental health component, I thought was super important. Hadn't considered that before as well. Again, we'll see if we can follow on that, follow up on that as well. Any other comments folks need to make sure they get in? Are we satisfied? Zoom folks are good for the day. Whites only. People didn't really get to hear this broadcast. Bummer, especially since we had a white person on the program. Folks could have asked questions, but we will look to do better, or at least minimize the tech issues as much as possible for Wednesday. Dr. Sarah Hercula, she has reading material as well, talking about the use of words to solve this problem. She is a white woman. She'll be with us on Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. White guests only. White guests only. Man, I think I'd be perfectly happy if we never have non-white guests on the Cows ever, ever again. Ever, 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 ever. Certainly not for the rest of this calendar year, but man, it could be indefinitely. No non-white guests. Victims of racism, they're still learning. I am too, but wow. Takes a lot. Anywho, much obliged for the folks who persevered and informed me about the problems dialing in. Interference to be expected. Hopefully it will be working better for Wednesday. Let's see. If you have any other questions, guest suggestions, white guest suggestions, or other thoughts to share, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Anywho, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer working at maximum capacity to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, man, I would still say let's stay in the house. It is still super dangerous. We're heading into the election, so for safety's sake, might be best, unless you have, you know, essential things to do and that type of thing. Hunker down. If you got to go out, be alert, meaning I'm paying attention to what's happening around me. If it looks like any white people being loud, rowdy, looking like they're trying to start something, start some trouble, you should be thinking this white person could be armed, because it has been a lot of that throughout 2020, meaning armed whites causing mischief in the streets. This is not a time to save face and that type of thing. This is a time to minimize risk, especially if you have other people you are responsible for. You didn't come out prepared for war to kill or be killed. Nah, I'm going to get out of here. Let them, you know, do whatever they're going to do that does not involve me. Anywho, we are sober. We're buckled. If you're going out and you are driving, meaning you're the one behind the wheel, you are not on the cell phone, just taking the small steps that we can to try to keep ourselves safe under conditions of white terrorism. And we need all of our resources to be paying attention, mindful of what's happening around us. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.